Good morning, everybody. My name is Garrett, and I'm a recovering alcoholic. Yeah. It is lovely to be here, you know. I'm from Ireland, as you can probably figure out. I hope you can understand me, and I try not to speak too fast, because Bruce was getting emails during the week. We'd need a translator. We could always use Jerry, of course, which would be very convenient. Or we could use kind of sign language. But hopefully you'll be able to understand what I'm here to do this morning. And really, what I'm here to do this morning, it's the same. It's just share about what it was like, what happened, and what's it like now. And that's all I am here to do this morning. One thing that I do like to get cleared up before this, by the way, is my first time doing this. I've never done this before. I have spoken in various places before, but I've never spoken at length in an AA speaker meeting. So it's a privilege. It's something that I never thought would happen. And it really is great to be here. I'll also try, if I can, for the next few minutes, while I am talking, not to maybe cry or get upset, that's what generally kind of happens at some stage. So if it does, you'll see me reaching down for the water. That's what the water is for. It's the man thing. Take a drink. You'll be okay. So I'm here because I've got an aunt living in Toronto that I like visiting once a year. And this is my fourth visit, my fourth trip to Toronto. And it was during that process that I came across Bruce, I think, at the Noon Rap Group downtown. And then we went for coffee one day, and would you believe it, Jerry over here came into the same Starbucks that we were in. And Jerry's family and my father's family lived originally maybe 150, 200 yards from one another. That is how this program works. I could not believe that this Jerry sitting over here knew my dad's family. I knew them and knew where they lived, knew all the streets, knew everything. Literally just a couple of blocks from one another. It was a marvelous experience. So that's how I got here. What I also like to try and qualify before I start speaking is that I am standing at a podium. I'm not on a podium. I am not trying to pretend I'm something I am not. I am an alcoholic. That's what I am, and that's what I accept I am today. For today. Growing up in Dublin, for me, it was a very happy occasion. Nothing bad happened to me when I was a kid. Nothing sort of out of the ordinary happened. I lived in a very regular family of one brother, two sisters, I'm the youngest. And we had a very, very sporting family. We were all into badminton. We represented our country at different levels of badminton. And nobody drank. My mum and dad don't drink. My dad's passed on, but my mum's still alive. They never drank. Drink wasn't an issue in our house. We used to have the same bottles at Christmas. Sitting on the sideboard that you'd have from the previous year, and the previous year, and the previous year. They just went down maybe a little bit for visitors that might come in who would have a drink. Drink was not an issue in our household. It just never arose. You know? So that's my kind of background. So I remember being in the treatment center, and they were plugging away at this thing. You know, there must be something in the genetics. There's something. You know, have you got your brother or your sister or your mama or your dad or your this or your that? And I kept saying, no, I don't. So the reason I'm an alcoholic is that I just am. It's not because of my past, it's not because of the present, it's just that's the way I am, right? I grew up, as I said, in a sporting family, and for some really strange reason, when I came to the age of 17 or 18, this school that I was in, which was run by a Catholic religious order. This guy came into the class one day and he said, would anybody like to join when you finish school? Well, I didn't want to disappoint him. So I said, hey. You know, so I did. I put up my hand and I went off and I talked to him afterwards and I actually found him to be a very interesting guy. So as a result, when I left school, about a month later after finishing school, I was about 18 years of age, I joined a religious order. For 10 years, I was a monk. Okay? I was in a teaching order that you would live together in community, and during the day you would go out and you would teach school, and you would come back to the community house and everybody would sort of live together and all that kind of stuff. And your first couple of years were very, very strict. You were allowed one phone call home, I think, per fortnight. I was allowed a letter a week. I was allowed one stamp to write to my family a week. And they were just the ground rules. And I liked it. I liked it because it gave me a sense of security. It gave me a great sense of loyalty, duty, spirituality, and it also kind of, there was a hidden life to it. There was something intriguing about it. We lived in these monasteries that nobody really knew what went on in them. The ordinary Joe soap in the street wasn't quite sure what was kind of happening, but that's where the brothers lived. And that stuck with me for quite a while. So after the initial induction of 2 years, I went off and I went to college and I got my teaching qualifications, and then I got out into the world of religious life, work. However, in that system, and I don't want to offend anybody here, and I hope this doesn't offend anybody here, but there was a huge drinking culture in that order, in that way of life. And it was a hidden form of drinking. That we would be up at 10 to 6 in the morning saying our prayers and doing all the religious things that needed to be done before you had breakfast. Then you would go and teach school. You'd come back to the house in the evening, you'd more prayers. But there was always a drinks cabinet. And the best thing of all was when you had visitors from another house would come to our house, our community house, and then all hell, like the shackles were off. You know? Because you had to be seen to be generous. We were always told, if you're going to err on the side of generosity. I erred frequently. I became an expert at erring. Because I, being the youngest in the house, my job was, I was living with men from my age of early 20s up to guys who had retired who were in their 90s and waiting to die. Some of them were still alive, but they were waiting to die, basically. So my job when visitors come was to be the host, you know. I used to kind of do the cooking and the cleaning and getting them ready, and then the drinks would start flowing. And my job was to go around and make sure everybody had a drink. And we had this thing called a monk's measure. And that's a monk's measure. Right? That's the shot of whiskey you got. Right? It was that size. Right? You got a tumbler, you fill it full of whiskey, and it had to be that size or else the boss, the superior of the house, wasn't doing his job properly. This young monk didn't know what he was doing. It had to be that, and that's what we drank. And then you go around with a little jug of water and they say, don't drown us. You know, you put in a dribble. You don't stop. You drown it. So drink became a part of my life. The other thing that happened was, as the young brother in the house, or maybe it was two or three of us, we drank the same amount as people who were older than us. And we were expected to maintain a certain uprightness. And that kind of helped, not like some people that, who were at the house. And we were supposed to kind of, you know, be, the more we drank, the better the young monk was. Was basically the modus operandi. we would then, at the end of the night, have to drive everybody home. Oh yeah, no, it's just par for the course, because we had our safety badge. Yeah, kind of put on your collar and away you go. Nobody was going to stop us. If the police pulled you over, hi, and you'd have your little sort of collar thing here, and you'd look at them and say, "How you doing?" And hi, brother, how you getting? Go on ahead. No problem. So we were, again, this hidden life, slightly above the law, slightly kind of out of kilter with what every other, and we were definitely treated slightly, very different at that time in Ireland. That's not the way it is now. But I became very adept at this drinking thing, and I became very adept at this vertical drinking. And that I could really, I found that I had a massive capacity for alcohol. Nobody knew whether I had one drink or 20 drinks inside me. Nobody knew whether I had to drink that much or drink that much. I would be able to carry myself. I was never kind of falling over or getting tipsy. I was logical. I was reasonable. I was all these kind of things. But it's where I really, looking back in hindsight, and I do not use these words in blame, it's where I did my drinking apprenticeship with senior men. That is just part of my story. It was 10 years that I spent as an apprentice drinker, along with other things. I decided at the age of 25 to leave the religious life. And I walked away from it, and I became a civilian again, and I was teaching away, and my career of primary school teaching took off, teaching small kids, elementary school, I think you call it here, and I enjoyed it. But what I found myself doing was, any time there was a staff party, we used to have to kind of, before the staff party, the younger members of the staff used to always meet up and have a few drinks before you got there. Just so that you were, you know, loosened up. You know? And I was also quite shy. I know that might seem strange because I'm standing up here this morning, but I am quite shy. Something that I've learned in sobriety, that I am quite shy. I might look kind of all confident and composed, but I'm not really. No, I'm not going to cry. I'm just having a drink. See, gotcha. But I found at social events that I was the one who was drinking the most. I also found a 5 o'clock club where, after work on a Friday, I used to meet up with a group of people who met at 5 o'clock on a Friday in a local pub, like most normal people do in Ireland, and have a few drinks and then go home. And I loved this sensation. You know Cheers? Remember Cheers that was on television, you know? Remember, you know, Norm, right? Okay, well, I'm a bit skinnier than Norm, hopefully. But I was Norm, and I loved being Norm. The door, the bar would open, and people would say, "Hey, hi, Gert." And I'd be there saying, "Hi." Yep, usual. Oh, yeah. And I'd have the paper under my arm, the Evening Herald. And I'd go in, you know, and Marino was where I used to kind of go, into cabinets in Marino. And usual. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I never sat down when I drank. That was when I drank. That was kind of cheating. I wanted to be where the action was, where the taps are. Went to barman. You know, I wasn't going to sit down in the corner. No. I wanted to be in the thick of it. The absolute thick of it. And I wanted to be where the serious drinkers were. I did not like amateur drinkers. I did not like Christmas time. Because all these fools of amateur drinkers would come out, have 2 glasses of wine, and would be falling all over the place, ruining my time in the pub, taking up my space, taking up, probably sitting on my seat, and probably using up the time of the barman who should be serving me, not them. They weren't there in the dark days on a Monday evening when there was no one else there, keeping the ship afloat. These were these amateur kind of drinkers that would come in, and I used to cringe. Oh God, I even had my own glass. Right? That might seem odd, but this is the actual truth. I had my own glass in one particular pub. And I didn't like going in. I preferred going in when the place was nice and quiet, because then I had the complete and utter undivided attention of the bar person. Right? The barman, generally. And I loved that, because I was the center of attention. And when I wanted a drink, I got it. Before I even finished the drink, my next one arrived. I loved the ritual of walking in like Norm did. Hi, how are you? Usual? Yeah. Never had to order a drink. Just the usual, yeah. You know? And I can still hear Guinness, and in Ireland, it's not like kind of you have here. You pull the tap, and I'll give you a quick history lesson here. And you have to fill the glass, the pint glass, three quarters of the way. And there's a hiss that comes out of the tap when it's filling up. There's a I can still hear that. You know? It's a ritual. And then you leave it down and it settles. It starts off white and suddenly it goes black, 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 black. And all the white stuff goes to the tap. And I don't know how it works, but it works. And then you top it off. Now that ritual takes about 5 minutes. And I can still feel the anticipation of that 5 minutes was electric. It really was. It was electric. And I have to say that it's still electric to me today. I have to be careful of it. Getting back into that ritual where I'm the person in the middle, where I'm the person who is the most important person in the room. There are dangerous territories for me to go into today. So I generally don't. As I said then, my career progressed, but so did my drinking. But it almost seemed that the more I drank, the better things got. I got out of teaching and I was offered a job with a computer company. I knew nothing about computers. Absolutely nothing. Had no idea. But this guy rang me, and he was a techie head. And he said, look, you're a teacher. He said, you can explain to people who aren't technical this piece of software that we have. I can't, and I can't sell this bloody stuff. So I came along and I learned what this thing did in very basic layman's language. Any technical questions, I said, here, ask him. And it took off. It actually worked very well, because I could talk the talk. If you can, as I said to Bruce earlier on this morning, if you can teach kindergarten that 1 and 1 equals 2, and they actually understand the concept, not just saying it back to you, you can walk into any boardroom in the world and feel quite comfortable. It's true. It's true. And that's what I found myself doing. Suddenly I was doing this type of thing to multinational companies. I was flying around, I was going everywhere, and I was getting drinks and free drinks and airports and planes and personal assistance, and jeez, it was great, it was all free. Yeah. So life was good. Life was very good. My sporting career took off as well. I was training, you know, serious sports teams, going out in front of 60, 70, 80,000 people, looking after, Jerry would understand, the Dublin GA football team. And they were, like, everything was just, if you tried to write a fairy tale, that's the way it was. I got married, I met a lovely girl at an Irish wedding where we now live. We got married in 1999, so I believe. I'll come back to that. No, that's a fact. So I believe I do have to qualify that. And hi, you're welcome. Good man yourself. And Everything was going good. We got a nice house. I had a great job. My wife is a teacher. She found a job nearby where we were living. We were kind of in a commuter town to Dublin. I was flying around the place a lot. I was working long hours, but I was making good money. And I was happy. And we were deliriously happy. But my drinking still was going on. Still there. I can remember the boss came up to me on a Friday and said, listen, we don't really want to see you in the office anymore on a Friday afternoon. Go home, avoid the traffic, just buzz off. Leave your phone on, pretend you're working. And I said, oh, great. So, because now we'd moved out of town, the 5 o'clock club thing kind of had died. But I decided to establish another one anyway. So, I used to drive home and I would park. There was a pub about 200 yards away from the house. And I'd drive around the back of the bar, and I'd park the car, and I'd go in the back way. And I'd ring my wife and say, oh, jeez, I'm just leaving the office. I'm on the way, hon. You know, traffic's going to be dreadful. It's Friday. 200 yards away from the house. You know? And I'd be drinking away. And then I'd ring her and say, but that was probably about 4. I'd ring at 6. Listen, oh, God, it's been a tough week. I'm going to stop in for one on the way home. Is that okay? And, of course, she'd say, yeah, fine. So I drive home at 7, having had 3 good hours of drinking inside me, instead of what she thought was maybe was 1 or 2 drinks. And again, it became very difficult. It was a hidden life. I was a very clever drinker. I had a huge capacity for alcohol, and I was very difficult to find out how much alcohol was inside my system. And this was the life that I led until something awful and dramatic happened to me. On the 21st of July 2001 at 8:53 p.m. It was a Saturday afternoon, Saturday evening, beautiful sunshine. I was bringing clients to what we call Crow Park. It would be the equivalent of your Rogers Centre here for a game on a Sunday. Corporate entertainment. So my wife knew that I wasn't going to be home till late, so she decided to go to her home place with the 9-month-old baby that we now had, Killian. And she went off. I was in the house on my own. Idle hands, sunshine. There was a soccer, local little soccer club, had a match on for the Saturday afternoon, and I said, I'll go to it. Didn't want to drink too much because I didn't want to be hungover for the Sunday game because that was serious, that was work, right? And I still had this thing about loyalty. I didn't want to leave anybody down. Went to the match, left the car at home, met a friend of mine at the game, had a couple of drinks after the match, and we came out. And we got into a car with a driver, and 5 minutes later we killed 3 people. We killed a 14-year-old girl, we killed her father, and the guy that I got into the car with was killed instantly as well. I was in the back seat. The only reason I was in the back seat was just as I got into the car, either I made a phone call or the phone rang, I'm not too sure. But it delayed me getting into the front seat because I was important. I wasn't going to sit in the back seat. I was in the front seat. That's how my self-esteem running amok. And so I got in the back seat. The driver of the car, for some strange reason, I still don't know. I don't remember this incident at all. This is all what has been told to me. The driver of the car decided to drive very fast, overtook a coach load of people, lost control of the car. And we crashed. I was fired out through the back window of the car, even though I had my seatbelt on. And I went straight across the road, all the way across a 2-lane road. We would call it kind of a main road. I don't know what you call it here. And I ended up in a heap unconscious on the ground. The car that I was in hit a ditch. That killed, unfortunately, my friend that was the passenger. He died instantly. And then it bounced back across into oncoming traffic. And bingo, that's unfortunately when the 14-year-old girl and her father died. They hit our car. The car then that I was in spun up in the air, and of all the crazy places it decided to land, it landed on top of me. So now I was dying. Now I was pinned underneath the car that nobody even knew I was there. A guy came along to the crash site and saw my hand sticking out from underneath the car. And he got a jack and he jacked up the car and he said, somebody's still alive here. There was chaos. Like, you know, there was dead bodies, bits, body parts. Crashes aren't nice. Body parts tend to fly. Luckily enough, they got me to a trauma center, or as we call it, an accident and emergency department, within this thing called the Golden Hour. I had shattered everything on my left side. I had a brain injury. I was paralyzed. I'd aspirated into my lungs. I was drowning. They resuscitated me twice. And a long road of recovery, physical recovery, began. I couldn't talk. I couldn't swallow. I couldn't really read. Couldn't concentrate. I have a brain injury. But I can distinctly remember a couple of things, which I'll share. I was in a coma for quite a long time. And I can remember being in that coma, having certain awarenesses. And I was lying in this bed, and I really thought that I was at home. I thought I was in the bed at home with my wife. Except I got a funny smell. And it was that clinically clean, hospitally smell, you know? So I knew I wasn't at home, and I knew that I was in the hospital. Second of all, I knew that something absolutely awful had happened, but I didn't know what. I presumed that my wife and child, 9-month-old baby, were dead. It was the worst thing I could think of. And the third thing that came into my mind over a period of time was I was going to die. I was in that much pain. I felt if I moved a millimeter, I was going to die. Luckily, that didn't happen. As I made my physical recovery, the biggest concern that I had, now think of it, I'm on a ventilator. I'm now kind of, you know, I'm doing this. I can open my eyes and I can see, you know. I couldn't move my left side. I could just move this arm, and trying to move it was, the effort was extraordinary. And I had this thought. I was in bits. I was in pieces. Nobody could tell me whether I was going to live or die. And yet, all I knew was, God, I hope something doesn't come in and tell me I'll never drink again. That was the worst thought that I could possibly think of. That was really bugging me. That's what was going through my head. Was, you know, because I heard of people that had diabetes and they couldn't drink again, and here was me, wrecked. I was going to use another word, I won't. That was one of the first thoughts that came to my head was, will I ever be, God, if they come in and tell me I can't drink again, what'll happen? So I made a physical recovery over a long, long, long period of time. And much to my shame and regret, I used my physical incapacitation to advance my drinking. Everybody felt sorry for me. Everybody thought I was a great guy. I was the survivor, right? And everybody wanted to buy me drinks, because that's what they do in Ireland when you're, you know, and they felt sorry for me. You know, I was in a wheelchair for quite a while. I was in crutches for 2 years. I was going to therapy. I couldn't do a lot. I couldn't remember things. I don't remember growing up. I don't remember getting married. That's why I threw in that thing about I believe I was still married. I don't remember getting married. I don't remember our son being born. I don't remember people really from my past. It's easier for me to stand here with strangers than it is with people who knew me from my past. But that's where my alcoholism, I think, just ramped up. It just took off. And I used it, much to my shame and regret. I suppose, what did it become like? As I became better, it became obvious I wasn't going to go back to work. I was going to become a house parent. House parents are, you know, I love it. You know, we've got, as I said, an 11-year-old boy now. But being a house parent, you've got gaps in the day when you can do things. You can get up early in the morning and have the dinner kind of prepared by 10 or 11. And it means you've got a few hours when Killian is in school. When he, you know, you've got maybe a couple of hours between 12 and 2. So I used to kind of toddle on downtown. I couldn't have a drink before midday because that meant you were an alcoholic. So I used to go down to one of the bars downtown, and I'd go in and I'd have coffee with friends, and I'd be looking at my watch, getting close, but I would not have a drink before midday. Then I would go down to a bar and I would have my drinks until, say, 2 o'clock. And I'd be looking at the clock, I'd be timing them, because I used to have to be at the school gate at 2:10, or 10 past 2 as we call it, to collect our son from school. And I would be there at 10 past 2 to collect our son from school, because I had this thing from the past of loyalty, commitment, hidden life. I was standing at the gate like every other parent. Stand there, upright, perfect, you know, giving off this aura of perfectness, or whatever you call that word. But except, I had already got 6 pints of cider inside me, and probably about 4 large brandies. And but nobody noticed. Nobody noticed. But that went on. Drink then became kind of a way of life, because I could fit it in, slot it in. And I did. And I did it tremendously well. Even our cooking, our food, became centered around alcohol. I would do the shopping on a Friday for, say, Monday's dinner. Casseroles, look. You want to drink, casseroles are the best thing ever. Right? Because you can prepare them in the morning, chop everything up. Everyone's gone to school, stick it in the oven for 4 or 5 hours, hey, yippee! They come back at 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock in the evening, you open the oven, and you're there, you know, because you've been 4 or 5 hours at that, but dinner's made. So my poor wife and family, you know, I used to go to great extremes where I'd have a bottle of wine that have opened, because I knew she could get the smell of drink. So I'd have a bottle of wine open, and I'd have half a glass of wine sitting on the sideboard when she'd come in from school. And she'd say, oh, right. Oh, I said, it was just her. God, she's a long day. And, you know, going back to the hidden life. I was downtown all day. But then of course, I had to, like, no point. Yeah, sure, open the bottle of wine. You know, have one yourself. Go on, you know. Oh, you don't want one? Okay. Oh, hey! So I'd have a bottle of wine. And it was also, that's what everybody, I never thought I had a problem with alcohol. Never. Never, ever thought I had a problem with alcohol. I was never barred from a pub. I never got into a pub fight. I never got into an issue about, barroom brawls or arguments and that sort of stuff. I was the perfect person. Except I was an alcoholic. I was, am, and always will be one. On March the 28th, 2008, the gap between trying to be the parent, the responsible, the good, upright citizen, and the alcoholic became too much. The stretch became too much. The mental gymnastics that I had to perform became too much. The gap began to grow wider. As my alcoholism increased, the gap became wider and wider and wider. And eventually, it snapped. Bang. I came home after having 4 drinks, and I said, that's it. I am not drinking again. I don't know why that happened. I didn't think that morning getting up that I wasn't going to drink again. I didn't have a hangover. I wasn't sick. I just made up my mind that I wasn't going to drink again. I needed help. And I was very fortunate that a man called Ali, who was my uncle-in-law, who was in this fellowship for a long, long time, about 2 years previously, had sown a seed in my head. And I knew exactly what to do, who to ring. I rang my GP, I rang a hospital, I rang AA. As a matter of fact as that. And I said, I need help. My wife came home and I said, I'm never drinking again. I can't do this. And sorry, that was the phrase that I used. I can't do this. She looked at me as if I had 2 heads. Because she still didn't fully understand the extent of my drinking. This mental disease that I had, it was eating away at me. I was rotten. Rotten inside. I was absolutely rotten inside. I was spiritually rotten, physically beaten, mentally tortured. I tortured myself. I'd get up in the morning with a hangover, but I'd be first up. I'd make sure I was first up out of bed. I'd be in the shower, singing, showering. I'd be dry reaching into a towel so nobody could hear me, thinking that nobody noticed. And God help my poor wife, she was really probably the person that only did notice. Most other people didn't really know. Where that moment of clarity came from, as we call it, I have no idea. But I absolutely thank God that it happened. Because since then, I live in a different world. I absolutely live in a different world. And so does my family. My wife, when I was in treatment, the, you know, family days used to come around where the family were supposed to kind of come in if they wished and talk to the counsellors and the client about their drinking. My wife just felt there really was not much point, so she wrote a letter. She said, I probably wouldn't listen to her anyway. But the letter that I got shook me. And I knew from growing up the difference between right and wrong. I still had that sense of when something was right and when something was wrong. And in that letter that she wrote to me, I knew that what I was doing, it was nothing to do with me anymore. It was to do with others. And I was really ruining people's lives, Killian and Mary's lives especially. I couldn't be trusted to be left with Killian to mind him. My wife had no social life, etc., 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 etc. And I knew that was wrong. That it was not the way life is supposed to be. So that's the awareness that I got in the treatment center. But then I started coming to meetings. And I just said that to Bruce this morning about, I was always worried that I could stop, but I couldn't stay stopped. I didn't know how to stay stopped. And that's what this program taught me. That's what this fellowship has taught me. We have got traditions. We have steps. We have big books. We have little books. We have pink books. We've got red books. We've got pamphlets. We've got this. We've got that. We've got the other. We've got all sorts. Really, the people that keep me, the thing that has kept me sober, are the people in these rooms. People that, like yourselves, I don't know. I'm somewhere outside Toronto. I don't even know the name of this place. It doesn't matter to me. Because where am I? I'm in an AA room. And for this alcoholic, there is no more perfect, safer, secure, happy, reliable place to be. I've run out of adjectives. I just can't think of any more. It is the most perfect place to be. Is to be in an AA room with people like me. To go back to what I said to Bruce this morning, when I came into this fellowship, nobody criticized me. Nobody made me feel guilty. I felt that enough. Nobody made me feel ashamed. I felt loved, cared for, wanted, accepted, arm around the shoulder. I felt warmth. I felt so much caring from people that didn't even know me that it enticed me to come back. If somebody had come up to me, being the typical Irish man, with, you know, do this, do this, do that, do that, do 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 do, I would have told them to buzz off. In fact, I would have told them to off. But, you know, because that's me. Now, what appealed to me about this program is that the love that's in it. And if we can get that love from a chronic alcoholic like me into somebody else, well, by God, we've done some job. Because doctors can't do it, psychiatrists can't do it, tablets can't do it, nobody can do it. The only one in this world, as far as I'm concerned, and this is my opinion, is we can do it. We can help others. And that is a wonderful thing to know. By being sober on a day-to-day basis, on a 24-hour basis, with my higher power, with our higher power, looking after us, minding us, a benevolent higher power, staying with us, caring for us. If we do 10%, you can be sure the HP will do 110%. You know, my higher power, I don't care whether you want to call it God, Buddha, Jesus, Salami, Pastrami, I don't care. Find something that you want to get at. Get a belief in a higher power. Because my higher power believes in me. I'm going to finish on this. I read this during the week. And I was debating about whether I was going to bring it or not. But I said, look, I will. So it's a bit of a... It was about the five C's. The five C's. And I loved it. It meant a lot to me. And the five C's in recovery are this. Confidence. That to me means trust in my higher power. I have absolute trust in my higher power. Because my higher power minded me. Through all the accident, throughout 10 years in the religious life, to the madness of things that I did, I was still minded by my higher power. Confession. The ability to share openly and honestly with others. That's what confession is. Conviction. Do I really want to be sober? Well, but the fact that you're in this room this morning, sitting on these chairs, means that at this moment, you want to be sober. That's conviction. Conversion. Can I change? I did change, and I keep needing to change. I have to change the people, places, and things. I have to change my mindset, and I have to get out of the friggin' middle of the world. Let somebody else, put somebody else in the middle of the day. Not me. When I was drinking, that's what it was all about, me. Sobriety, that's not the way I, in my experience, feel. The more I put others first, the better my day gets. That's conversion. And the last one is continuance. Constant effort. Whatever it is. Jeez, do it. Whether it's saying your prayers in the morning, reading a 24-hour book, you know, doing a bit of service, getting your ass to a meeting, taking a phone call that you don't really want to take, making a phone call that you definitely don't want to make, saying sorry to somebody, God, I'm useless at that. But I try and make an effort. And once I keep trying to make that effort, life is worth living. Because of two choices. I can go back to the alcohol and the misery, or I can go back to recovery, service, unity, sobriety, and life out there. And that's my choice today. Because I've got a higher power. The fellowship of this amazing group of people. And people like you sitting here listening to me. If we can do that today. And do it tomorrow. You know, things will work out. And hence here am I, 3,500 miles away from home. I don't really know where I am. I know I'm getting the GO Transit, I think at 12:30 to go back to Toronto. But it's great. I don't need to know. This is what I'm going to finish up. An elder, Lee Mann, came up to me, a man in his fellowship, a long, long time ago. And he said, Garrett, he said, you've got to slow down. He said, you've got a problem. You don't even know you got a problem. Now, this is when I was around a while. And he said, I just couldn't get it. You know fish fingers? Have you got that brand? You know fish fingers that you get for kids? Have you got them over here, yeah? Yeah? Do you have the brand called Captain Birdseye? Right, there's a Captain Birdseye. It's a famous brand at home. And he's the captain of the ship. And Captain Birdseye is on every fish finger box. And this guy, this elderly man said, listen, he said, Garrett, will you stop trying to be Captain Birdseye and be happy to be just one of the fish fingers in the box? Penny dropped. All of a sudden, I don't have to be the center of attention. I don't have to be the middle of the day. I don't have to be using my sobriety as a weapon. Because that's another story. It's an aside. I'm just happy just to be. Whatever happens, happens. But at least, thank Christ, we're all here safe and sober today, now at 11 o'clock. I hope you have a lovely day. Thanks for having me, and just keep at it.